Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in K-9 units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This is chemical warfare that you're not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras. Right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African-American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that the by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel. Because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964. Yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this, the police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
Mm-hmm. And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American-Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add
something? I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale, of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowds in support of the black.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera, that's my weapon, you know, and the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
An endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is valuable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed in the film?
Well,
because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. new technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long, and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as
a brief break now from the discussion. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean, everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on, and
it seems that
we're
her
people
head.
Are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
So Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The keys of life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to...
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Now, the stage has come now where we speak about how to deal with enemies, or how to deal with people who are not in favor of us. Now, how about when it is enemy, if we could say enemy of your religion, enemy of the state, if we could say. You know, here the responsibility is greater. It's no longer an individual case. It's no longer individual responsibility. It's not someone personally attacking me, in which maybe I might become a little bit emotional. Maybe I might have a clouded judgment in the way I react and things like that. And I always need to keep Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala between my eyes and make sure that I'm not doing something wrong, or, as I said, you know, going down to their level. But when it comes to an enemy of religion, then it is relatively more critical and dangerous. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes on the fundamental role that we need to have in dealing with this kind of case. Important thing, as I would like to say again, is for us to find ways of avoiding any kind of confrontation or avoiding any kind of hostile person coming our way, which is exactly why we should stay away from disputes, stay away from places or areas or individuals who we know, you know, are going to be problematic for us, are going to give us a headache, you know, and neutralize. That's what we should do, neutralize the situation in any case. When it comes to the enemy of religion, which is a very, very sensitive topic, you know, it's not something that we in any way should take into our own hands. We should always remember that we need to consult with our religion, with the true teachings of our religion. And alhamdulillah, as the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, during the time of the ghaiba of Imam al-Mahdi ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, we have a hierarchy of authority. And that hierarchy of authority comes from our ulama, comes from our maraji' taqlid, where they issue statements and fatwas on how we need to deal with these kind of situations that unfold in front of us. We can't take things into our own hand. We need to also remember that we have a law of the land that we are living in that we need to honor and we need to respect. And this is the view of all of our fuqaha. You know, it's not that we are giving in. It's not that we as Muslims need to, you know, contort ourselves and allow ourselves to be degraded or humiliated. Never is that the case. However, at the same time, seeing that it is sensitive, seeing that it is something even more dangerous, we need to be very, very cautious about it. And again, our first enemy is the shaitan. When we're talking about enemy, we're not talking about those who are attacking Islam from the outside. We need to be talking about those who are attacking us from the inside, which is also something shaitani as well. we need to be prepared for that as well, which is exactly why the first thing that Sheikh Jawadi Amuli says, that the first most dangerous enemy of us as a religion is shaitan itself. Managing these issues and being wise and realizing what the repercussions are is also very, very important as well.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
We need to have that sense of tawalli and tabarri, where we align ourselves with awliya Allah, where we align ourselves with those who are in favor of God and Ahlul Bayt and Islam, and those who are against Islam, in the sense they have clearly stated their position as being an enemy of Islam and Muslims, then we need to do tabarri. Tabarri is, of course, of different stages. Tabarri doesn't mean that you prepare yourself with weapons and go on jihad and attack them and things like that. No, tabarri is of different stages as well. You know, and the least of that is that we disassociate ourselves with them. And that's what tabarri means. This is why Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, he said to Jabir ibn Abdullah radiyallahu ta'ala an, لا تستعن بعدو لنا. Do not seek assistance from one of our enemies. في حاجة, in any needs. ولا تستطعمه ولا تسأله شربة. And don't feed them or ask them for any kind of drink or anything. Which basically means don't associate with these kind of individuals. Make your position, make your stance very, very clear that you do not associate yourself with these kind of people who have clearly shown their hostility towards Islam and towards Muslimin. Now, does this mean that you also become aggressive, that you do this? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But at the same time, you know, preparation is extremely important as well. You know, you need to prepare yourself mentally, you need to prepare yourself intellectually. You know, a lot of these things come down to fighting with the pen, you know, and as they say, the pen is mightier than the sword. In many cases, you know, you are able to articulate your defense of Islam by sharing an article, by writing a book, by saying something, you know, that would clarify many, many misconceptions that are out there. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream,
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
UK Parliament's Public Accounts Committee warned earlier this year that the government was not doing enough to prevent damage from flooding and said councils and local authorities needed much more help, including more cash. We have prepared for you an article written by environment correspondent Fiona Harvey under the heading, Scientists Say Flash Floods Will Be More Common As Climate Crisis Worsens. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Scientists have warned flash flooding of the type seen in London recently will become a more common occurrence as the climate crisis worsens. And the British government, businesses and householders must do much more to protect against future harm. Dr. Jess Neumann, a hydrologist at the University of Reading, said, "Flooding from intense summer rainfall is going to happen more frequently. No city, town or village is immune to flooding. And we all need to take hard action right now if we are to prevent impacts from getting worse in the future." Climate policy in the United Kingdom has focused on cutting greenhouse gas emissions, which is a primary concern, to reduce the human impact on the climate and ensure global heating does not reach catastrophic levels. But the government has also been warned frequently that measures to cope with the impacts of extreme weather are urgently needed, and that the United Kingdom has been falling behind on such adaptive measures. Adapting to the impacts will require a thorough overhaul of the UK's infrastructure, encompassing not only drainage and water supply systems and transport, to ensure they're not overwhelmed, as many in London were at the recent flash flooding, but also energy supply and communication networks. Buildings will need to be redesigned and public areas revamped to include better drainage channels and storm drains, while more innovative approaches could include porous pavements. Experts warned a lack of green space and vegetation and the paving over of many areas without heed to flood risk has compounded the problem in many cities, including London. And also, this needs to be addressed. Dr. Jess Neumann, a hydrologist from the University of Reading, said planning and development needs to consider flood risk and all sources, river, groundwater and flash floods, and adapt accordingly. It is not acceptable to keep paving over the land and expect the public to deal with the water when it comes into their homes. One of the problems is that responsibility for flood protection in the United Kingdom is split among many authorities, with little central oversight. Liz Stevens, Associate Professor of Climate Resilience at Reading University, said, "The United Kingdom still has a complicated set of roles and responsibilities for surface water flooding risk. Lead local flood authorities take responsibility for managing it, the Environment Agency for mapping it, and the Met Office for providing early warning. This makes it difficult for the public to have a good understanding of their own risk and what can be done." She said there was a lack of even basic data caused by a refusal to invest in more precise research. She said the surface water flood hazard maps for the UK have not been improved since 2013. These urgently need updating. The current accuracy of surface water flood maps reflect an investment choice and not what is possible with the state-of-the-art science. She added, "It is difficult to help people prepare for surface water flooding if they don't know they are at risk, and if they don't receive precise warnings of the likely impacts when heavy rain is forecast." The British Parliament's Public Accounts Committee warned earlier this year that the government was not doing enough to prevent damage from flooding, and said councils and local authorities needed much more help, including more cash. Meg Hillier, the chair of the committee and a London MP, told The Guardian, "The recent floods highlighted the government's inaction." She said, "This latest flooding underlines the committee's concerns about the resources available for floods, which are becoming more frequent." She added, "Flash flooding from torrential rain causes havoc for those affected, and yet the lack of resources for councils, which are responsible for the mitigation of urban flooding, is hampering the response with businesses and householders so desperately need." Darren Rodwell, environment spokesperson at the Local Government Association, which represents local councils, echoed Meg Hillier's call. Darren Rodwell said, "Councils are best placed to ensure that flood defence money is directed towards projects that best reflect local needs, including protecting key roads and bridges to keep local residents and businesses moving. Funding for flood defences needs to be devolved to local areas and sit within a new national framework for addressing the climate emergency. Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, said his powers were limited on flood defences, but he was dealing urgently with Thames Water on this issue. He said, "We are seeing increasing incidents of extreme weather events linked to climate change." Sadiq Khan added, "This is not the first time in recent weeks that London has been hit by major flooding. Despite having limited powers in the area, it remains a key priority for myself and London Council leaders that more is done urgently to tackle flooding and the other impact of climate change. This includes continuing to urge Thames Water, the UK's largest water and wastewater services company, to address localised issues with infrastructure that may exacerbate the impact of flooding. Insurers are among those most concerned about the impact of climate breakdown and have warned the British households and businesses in some areas could find themselves uninsurable if stronger action is not taken. Adam Winslow, the chief executive of Aviva General Insurance, said, "It's too late to stop the effects of climate change from happening, but we can reduce the impact it will have on our lives. Action is needed now to improve regulation about where and how properties are built, encourage the use of resilient materials, and consider innovative and natural solutions to climate change."
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States this year. In a mid-year report, America's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization detailed several instances of incidents including hate crimes, harassment, school bullying, discrimination, and hate speech. The Council documented a spike in anti-Muslim incidents in May and June, including 4 at mosques in May alone. These cases include vandalism, harassment towards women who wear hijab or headscarf, and an attempt at stabbing. The spike coincided with Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip that ended in a May 21st ceasefire and killed at least 250 Palestinians.
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, I think Donald Trump brought white nationalism and discrimination and even racism against Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians into mainstream American political discourse. The other reason is, of course, that Israel launched an attack on Gaza in May of 2021. For 11 days, they bombed Gaza, and the militant groups in Gaza retaliated by firing rockets back into Israel.
The growing number of anti-Muslim hate incidents is drawing reactions from the U.S. Congress, too. Minnesota's Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar is leading a group of lawmakers calling on the U.S. President Joe Biden to nominate a special envoy to combat Islamophobia. The group has pointed to a rising number of individuals connected to larger white supremacist networks as perpetrators of Islamophobia. In a letter to U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar also referred to a June 6 car attack in Canada that killed 4 members of the same Muslim family.
"Their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred in the heart of one of our communities."
The National Council of Canadian Muslims urged Trudeau to address what it called the deep-seated systemic Islamophobia in the country, suggesting the appointment of a special envoy to confront the issue. Back in March, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited a UN report which found that suspicion, discrimination, and outright hatred towards Muslims has risen to, quote, epidemic proportions.
Anti-Muslim bigotry is certainly in line with other distressing trends we are seeing globally. A resurgence in ethno-nationalism, neo-Nazism, stigma and hate speech targeting vulnerable populations, including Muslims, Jews, some minority Christian communities, as well as others.
But this is a relatively new phenomenon. The anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim view has had, you know, over 100 years of being part of the American psyche, and the pro-Israel forces, both the evangelical Christians and, of course, the Zionist Jews, have been very, very successful in getting their narrative accepted without question.
Limitations on Muslims sharing their beliefs, discrimination on receiving citizenship, and defaming Muslim communities were some manifestations of anti-Muslim biases the UN chief mentioned. Guterres added that Muslim women face triple levels of discrimination because of their gender, ethnicity, and faith, while the media and some persons in power have further compounded the stereotypes. The UN has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools, or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading, "Wake up Australia," and "Drain the swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and farmer supported, community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called Community Supporting Agriculture. And they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.